I'll be fine, he whispered. Should be fine now. Mum reached back through the seats and mouthed, plastic bag. Tansy handed over hers. Just in case, she said cheerfully, and opened her window a bit. Mr. Nichols drove really slowly for the next few miles, so slowly that two cars kept flashing them from behind, and one driver sat on his horn really angrily as he passed. Sometimes he veered a bit across the white line, like he wasn't really concentrating, but Tansy registered Mum's determined silence and decided not to say anything. How long now? Mr. Nichols kept muttering. Not long, said Mum, even though she probably had no idea. She patted his arm like he was a child. You're doing really well. When he looked at her, his eyes were anguished. Hang on in there, she said quietly, and it was like an instruction. And then, about half a mile further along, Oh God, he said, and slammed the brakes on again. I need to... Pub! Mum yelled, and pointed towards one, its light just visible on the outskirts of the next village. Look! You can make it! Mr. Nichols's foot went down on the accelerator so that Tansy's cheeks were pulled back in G-force. He skidded into the car park, threw the door open, staggered out, and hurled himself inside. They sat there, waiting. The car was so quiet that they could hear the engine ticking. After 5 minutes, Mum leant across and pulled his door shut to keep the chill out. She looked back and smiled at them. How was that aero? Nice. I like aeros too. Nicky, his eyes closed, nodded to the music. A man pulled into the car park with a woman wearing a high ponytail and looked hard at the car. Mum smiled. The woman did not smile back. 10 minutes went by. Shall I go and get him? Said Nicky, pulling his earbuds from his ears and peering at the clock. Best not, said Mum. Her foot had started tapping. Another 10 minutes passed. Finally, when Tansy had taken Norman for a walk around the car park, and Mum had done some stretches on the back of the car because she said she was bent out of shape, Mr. Nichols emerged. He looked whiter than anyone Tansy had ever seen, like paper. He looked like someone had rubbed at his features with a cheap eraser. I think we might need to stop here for a bit, he said. In the pub? Not the pub, he said, glancing behind him. Definitely not the pub. Maybe somewhere a few miles away? Do you want me to drive? Mum said. No! Everyone said at once, and she smiled and tried to look like she wasn't offended. The Bluebell Haven was the only place within 10 miles that wasn't fully booked. It had 18 static caravans, a playground with 2 swings, and a sandpit, and a sign that said, No dogs. Mr. Nichols let his face drop against the steering wheel. We'll find somewhere else, he winced and doubled over. Just... Give me a minute. No need. You said you can't leave the dog in the car. We won't leave him in the car. Tansy, said Mum, the sunglasses. There was a mobile home by the front gate marked reception. Mum went in first, and Tansy put the sunglasses on and waited outside on the step, watching through the bubbled glass door. The fat man, who raised himself wearily from a chair, said she was lucky as there was only one still available, and they could have it for a special price. How much is that? Said Mum. £80. For one night, in a static? It's Saturday. And it's 7 o'clock at night, and you had nobody in it. Someone might still come. Yeah, I heard Madonna was having a swift half down the road and looking for somewhere to park her entourage. No need to be sarky. No need to rip me off. £30, Mum said, pulling the notes from her pocket. £40. £35, Mum held out a hand. It's all I've got. Oh, and we've got a dog. He lifted a meaty hand. Read the sign. No dogs. He's a guide dog for my little girl. I'd remind you that it's illegal to bar a person on the grounds of disability. Nikki opened the door, and holding her elbow guided Tansy in. She stood motionless behind her dark glasses while Norman stood patiently in front of her. They had done this twice when they had to catch the coach to Portsmouth after Dad had left. "He's well trained," Mum said. "He'll be no trouble." "He's my eyes," Tansy said. "My life would be nothing without him." The man stared at her hand, and then at her. His jowls reminded Tansy of Norman's. She had to remember not to glance up at the television. "You're busting my balls, lady." "Oh, I do hope not," Mum said cheerfully. He shook his head, withdrew his huge hand, and moved heavily towards a key cabinet. "Golden Acres, second lane, fourth on the right, near the toilet block." Mr. Nichols was so ill by the time they reached the static that it was possible he didn't even notice where they were. He kept moaning softly and clutching his stomach, and when he saw the words toilets, he let out a little cry and disappeared. They didn't see him for the best part of an hour. Golden Acres wasn't gold and didn't look anything like even half an acre, but Mum said any port in a storm. There were two tiny bedrooms, and the sofas in the living room turned into another bed. Mum said that Nikki and Tansy could stay in the one with twin beds, Mr. Nichols could go in the other, and she would have the sofa. It was actually okay in their bedroom, even if Nikki's feet did hang over the end of his bed, and everywhere smelt of cigarettes. Mum opened some windows for a bit, then made up the beds with the duvets and ran the water until it came hot because she said Mr. Nichols would probably want a shower when he came back in. Tansy opened all the cupboards, which were made of chipboard, one after another, shut the floral curtains and inspected the chemical loo in the bathroom, then pressed her nose to the window and counted all the lights in the other static caravans. Only two seemed to be occupied. "That lying git," said Mum. She had put her phone on to charge for precisely 15 seconds when it rang. She started and picked it up, still plugged into the wall. "Hello?" She sounded like she thought it might be Mr. Nichols calling from the toilet block for more paper again. "Des?" Her hand flew to her mouth. "Oh God, Des, I'm not going to make it back in time." A series of muffled explosions at the other end. "I'm really sorry. I know what I said, but things have gone a bit crazy. I'm in..." She pulled a face at Tansy. "Where are we?"
"Near Ashby de la Zouche," she said.
"Ashby de la Zouche," Mum repeated, and then her hand in her hair. "Ashby de la Zouche. I know. I'm really sorry. The journey didn't quite go as I planned, and our driver got sick, and my phone ran out, and with all the..." "What?" She glanced at Tansy. "I don't know. Probably not before Tuesday. Maybe even Wednesday. It's taking longer than we thought." Tansy could definitely hear him shouting then. "Can't Chelsea cover it? I've done enough of her shifts." "I know it's the busy period. I know, Des. I'm really sorry. I've said I..." She paused. "No, I can't get back before then. No, I'm really..." "What do you mean? I've never missed a shift this past year. I..." "Des? Des?" She broke off and stared at the phone. "Was that Des from the pub?" Tansy liked Des from the pub. Once she had sat outside with Norman on a Sunday afternoon, waiting for Mum, and he had given her a packet of scampi fries. At that minute, the door to the caravan opened, and Mr. Nichols pretty much fell in. "Lie down," he muttered, pulled himself briefly upright, then collapsed onto the floral sofa cushions. He looked up at Mum with a grey face and big hollow eyes.
"Lying down, sorry," he mumbled.
Mum just sat there, staring at her mobile. He blinked at her, registering the phone, and muttered,
"Were you trying to reach me?"
"He sacked me," Mum said. "I don't believe it. He's bloody sacked me."
Chapter 17. Chess. The night took on a weird, disjointed quality, the hours running into each other, fluid and endless. She gave up trying to sleep. She stared at the caramel-coloured, wipe-clean walls of the caravan, read a bit, dozed. Mr. Nichols groaned beside her, occasionally getting up to shuffle backwards and forwards to the toilet block. She closed the kids' door and sat waiting for him in the little caravan, sometimes dozing on the far end of the L-shaped sofa, handing him water and tissues when he staggered in. Shortly after 3, Mr. Nichols said he wanted a shower. She made him promise to leave the bathroom door unlocked, took his clothes down to the laundrette, a washer-dryer in a shed, and spent £3.20 on a 60-minute cycle. She didn't have any change for the dryer. He was still in the shower when she arrived back at the caravan. She draped his clothes from hangers over the heater, hoping they might dry a bit by morning, then knocked quietly on the door. There was no answer, just the sound of running water and a belch of steam. She peeped around the door. The glass was clouded, but she could make him out, slumped and exhausted on the floor. She waited a moment, stared at his broad back pressed against the glass panel, an oddly beautiful, pale inverted triangle, then watched as he lifted his hand and ran it wearily over his face. "Mr. Nichols," she whispered behind him. Then again, when he didn't say anything, "Mr. Nichols." He turned then and saw her. His eyes were red-rimmed, and his head sunk deep into his shoulders. "Fuck's sake, I can't even get up, and the water's starting to go cold," he said.
"Want me to help?"
"No." "Yes, Jesus. Hold on." She held up the towel. Whether to shield him or herself, she wasn't sure. Reached in and turned off the shower, soaking her arm. Then she crouched down so that he could cover himself and leant in.
"Put your arm around my neck."
"You're tiny. I'll just pull you over."
"I'm stronger than I look."
He didn't move.
"You're going to have to help me here. I'm not up to a fireman's lift."
His wet arm slid around her. He hooked the towel around his waist. Jess braced herself against the wall of the shower, and finally, shakily, they stood. Usefully, the RV was so small that at every step there was a wall for him to lean on. They made their way unsteadily to the couch.
"This is what my life has come to," he groaned, eyeing the bucket as she placed it beside the bed. "Yep." Jess viewed the peeling wallpaper, the nicotine-stained paintwork. "Well, I've had better Saturday nights myself." She made herself a cup of tea. It was a little after 4. Her eyes were gritty and sore, and she felt light-headed. She sat down and closed them for a minute. "Thanks," he said weakly.
"What for?" He pushed himself upright. "For bringing loo roll out to me in the middle of the night, for washing my disgusting clothes, for helping me out of the shower, and for not once acting like it was my own fault for buying a dodgy doner from a place called Keith's Kebabs."
"Even though it was your own fault."
"See, now you're spoiling it." He lay back on the pillow, his forearm over his eyes. She tried not to look at the broad expanse of chest above the strategically placed towel. She couldn't remember when she'd last seen a man's naked torso, other than at Des's ill-advised pub beach volleyball match the previous August.
"Go and lie down in the bedroom. You'll be more comfortable."
He opened one eye. "Do I get a SpongeBob duvet?"
"You get my pink stripy one, but I promise not to regard it as any reflection whatsoever on your masculinity."
"Where will you sleep?"
"Out here. It's fine," she said, as he started to protest. "I'm not sure I'll sleep much now anyway."
He let her lead him into the tiny bedroom. He groaned as he collapsed onto the bed, as if even that caused him discomfort, and she pulled the duvet over him gently. The shadows under his eyes were ash-coloured, and his voice had become drowsy. "I'll be ready to go in a couple of hours."
"Sure you will," she said, observing the ghostly pallor of his skin. "Take your time. Where the hell are we, anyway? On the Yellow Brick Road? Is that the one with the godlike lion who saves everyone? You're thinking of Narnia. This one is cowardly and useless. Figures. And finally, he slept.
Jess left the room silently and lay down on the narrow sofa under a peach-coloured blanket that smelt of damp and furtively smoked cigarettes, and tried not to look at the clock. She and Nicky had studied the map while Mr. Nichols was in the toilet block the previous evening and had reconfigured the journey as best they could. "We still have plenty of time," she told herself. And then, finally, she, too, slept. All was silent within Mr. Nichols's room well into the morning. Jess thought about waking him, but each time she made a move towards his door, she remembered the sight of him slumped against the shower cabinet, and her fingers stilled on the handle. She opened the door only once, when Nicky pointed out that it was just possible he had choked to death on his own vomit. He seemed the faintest bit disappointed when it turned out Mr. Nichols was just in a really deep sleep. The children took Norman up the road, Tansy in her dark glasses for authenticity, bought supplies from a convenience store, and breakfasted in whispers. Jess converted the remaining bread into sandwiches.
"Oh, good," said Nicky.
Cleaned the caravan for something to do, went outside, and left a message on Des's answer phone, apologising again. He didn't pick up. At 10:30, the door of the little room opened with a squeak, and Mr. Nichols emerged, blinking, in his T-shirt and boxers. He raised a palm in greeting. He looked disoriented, a castaway waking on an island. A long crease bisected his cheek from the pillow.
"We are in
Ashby de la Zouche, or somewhere nearby. It's not quite beachfront." "Is it late?"
"Quarter to 11."
"Quarter to 11. Okay." His jaw was thick with stubble, and his hair stuck up on one side. Jess pretended to read her book. He smelt of warm, sleepy mail. She had forgotten what a weirdly potent scent that was. "Quarter to 11. He rubbed at the stubble on his chin, then walked unsteadily to the window and peered out. "I feel like I've been asleep for a million years." He sat down heavily on the sofa cushion opposite her, running his hand over his jaw. "Dude," said Nicky from beside her. "Jailbreak alert."
"What?"
Nicky waved a biro.
"You need to put the prisoners back in the pen."
Mr. Nichols stared at him, then turned to Jess as if to say, "Your son has gone mad."
"Oh, God,"
he frowned.
"Oh, God, what?"
Following Nicky's gaze, Jess looked down and swiftly away.
"You could at least have taken me out to dinner first," she said, standing to clear the breakfast things.
"Oh," Mr. Nichols looked down and adjusted himself.
"Sorry."
"Right.
Okay."
He stood and made for the bathroom.
Am I okay to have another shower?"
"We saved you some hot water," said Tansy, who was head down over her exam sheet in the corner.
"Well, actually, all of it. You smelt really bad yesterday."
He emerged 20 minutes later, his hair damp and smelling of shampoo, his jaw clean-shaven. Jess was busy whisking salt and sugar into a glass of water and trying not to think about what she had just seen. She handed it to him.
"What's that?"
He pulled a face. "Rehydrating solution, to replace some of what you lost last night." "You want me to drink a glass of salty water, after I've spent all night being sick?"
"Just drink it."
She was too tired to argue with him. While he was grimacing and gagging, she fixed him some plain toast and a black coffee. He sat across the little formica table, took a sip of coffee and a few tentative bites of toast, and 10 minutes later, in a voice that held some surprise, acknowledged that he did actually feel a bit better. Better as in able to drive without having an accident better? "By having an accident you mean not crashing into a lay-by." "Thank you for clarifying that." He took another more confident bite of toast. "Yeah. Give me another 20 minutes, though. I want to make sure I'm
safe in cars."
"Ha." He grinned. And it was curiously pleasing to see him smile.
"Yes, Quite. Oh, man, I do feel better.
He ran a hand across the plastic-covered table and took a swig of coffee, sighing with apparent satisfaction. He finished the first round of toast, asked if there was any more going, then looked around the table. Although, you know, I might feel even better if you weren't all staring at me while I eat. I'm worried some other part of me is poking out.
You'll know, said Nicky, because we'll all run screaming.
Mum said you pretty much brought up an organ, said Tansy. I was wondering what it felt like.
He glanced up at Jess and stirred his coffee. He didn't shift his gaze until she had blushed.
Truthfully, not so different from most of my Saturday nights these days.
He drank the rest and put down his cup.
Okay, I'm good. The rogue kebab is defeated. Let's hit the road.
The landscape altered by the mile as they drove through the afternoon, the hills growing steeper and less bucolic, the walls that banked them morphing from hedgerows into flinty grey stone. The skies opened. The light around them grew brighter, and they passed the distant symbols of an industrial landscape. Red brick factories, huge power stations that belched mustard-coloured clouds. Jess watched surreptitiously as Mr. Nichols drove, at first wary that he would suddenly clutch his stomach, and then later with a vague satisfaction at the sight of normal colour returning to his face.
"I don't think we're going to make Aberdeen today," he said, and there was a hint of apology in his voice. "Let's just get as far as we can and do the last stretch early tomorrow morning."
"That's exactly what I was going to suggest.
Still loads of time."
"Loads."
She let the miles roll by, dozed intermittently, and tried not to worry about all the things she needed to worry about. She positioned her mirror surreptitiously so that she could watch Nicky in the back seat. His bruises had faded, even in the short time they had been away. He seemed to be talking more than he had been, but he was still close to her. Sometimes, Jess worried he would be like that for the rest of his life. Didn't seem to make any difference how often she told him she loved him or that they were his family.
"You're too late," her mother had said when Jess had told her he was coming to live with them.
"With a child that age, the damage has been done. I should know."
As a schoolteacher, her mother could keep a class of 38-year-olds in a narcoleptic silence, could steer them through tests like a shepherd streaming sheep through a pen. But Jess couldn't remember her ever smiling at her with pleasure. The kind of pleasure you're meant to get just from looking at someone you gave birth to. She had been right about many things. She had told Jess on the day she started secondary school, "The choices you make now will determine the rest of your life." All Jess heard by then was someone telling her she should pin her whole self down like a butterfly. That was the thing. When you put someone down all the time, eventually they stop listening to the sensible stuff. When Jess had had Tansy, young and daft as she had been, she'd had enough wisdom to know she was going to tell her how much she loved her every day. She would hug her and wipe her tears and flop with her on the sofa with their legs entwined like spaghetti. She would cocoon her in love. When she was tiny, Jess had slept with her in their bed, her arms wrapped around her, so that Marty would haul himself grumpily into the spare room, moaning that there wasn't any room for him. She barely even heard him. And when Nicky had turned up 2 years later, and everyone had told her she was mad to take on someone else's child, a child who was already 8 years old and from a troubled background, you know how boys like that turn out, she'd ignored them. Because she could see instantly in the wary little shadow, who had stood a minimum 12 inches away from anyone, from his father even, a little of what she had felt. Because she knew that something happened to you when your mother didn't hold you close or tell you all the time that you were the best thing ever, or even notice when you were home, a little part of you sealed over. You didn't need her, you didn't need anyone. And without even knowing you were doing it, you waited. You waited for anyone who got close to you to see something they didn't like in you, something they hadn't seen initially, and to grow cold and disappear, like so much sea mist too. Because there had to be something wrong, didn't there? If even your own mother didn't really love you.
It was why she hadn't been devastated when Marty left. Why would she be? He couldn't hurt her. The only thing Jess really cared about was those two children, and letting them know that they were okay by her. Because even if the whole world was throwing rocks at you, if you still had your mother or father at your back, you'd be okay. Some deep-rooted part of you would know you were loved, that you deserved to be loved. Jess hadn't done much to be proud of in her life, but the thing she was most proud of was that Tansy knew it. Strange little bean that she was, Jess knew she knew it. She was still working on Nicky.
Are you hungry?
Mr. Nichols's voice woke her from a half-doze. She pushed herself upright. Her neck had calcified, as bent and stiff as a wire coat hanger. Starving, she said, turning awkwardly towards him. You want to stop somewhere for lunch? The sun had emerged. It shone in actual rays off to their left, strobing a vast open field of green. God's fingers, Tansy used to call them. Jess reached for the map in the glove compartment, ready to look up the location of the next services. Mr. Nichols glanced at her. He seemed almost embarrassed.
Actually, you know what? I could really go for one of your sandwiches.
Chapter 18. Ed. The Stag and Hounds B&B wasn't listed in any accommodation guides. It had no website, no brochures. It wasn't hard to work out why. The pub sat alone on the side of a bleak, windswept moor, and the mossy plastic garden furniture that stood outside its grey frontage suggested an absence of casual visitors, or perhaps the triumph of hope over experience. The bedrooms were apparently last decorated several decades previously, and bore shiny pink wallpaper, doilied curtains, and a smattering of china figurines in place of anything useful, like, say, shampoo or tissues. There was a communal bathroom at the end of the upstairs corridor, where the sanitary ware was a non-ironic avocado, and the pink soap was bisected by dark grey fissures. A small box-shaped television in the twin room deigned to pick up three channels, and each of those with a faint static buzz. When Nicky discovered the plastic Barbie doll in a crocheted wool ball dress that squatted over the loo roll, he was awestruck. "I actually love this," he said, holding her up to the light to inspect her glittery synthetic hem. "It's so bad, it's actually cool." Ed couldn't believe places like this still existed. But he had been driving for a little over 8 hours at 40 miles per hour. The Stag and Hounds was £25 per night per room, a rate even Jess was happy with. And they were happy to let Norman in. "Oh, we love dogs." Mrs. Deakins waded through a small flock of excitable Pomeranians. She patted her head, on which a carefully pinned structure sat like a small ginger cottage loaf. "We love dogs more than humans, don't we, Jack?" There was a grunt from somewhere downstairs. "They're certainly easier to please. You can bring your lovely big fella into the snug tonight if you like. My girls love to meet a new man." She gave Ed a faintly saucy nod as she said this. She opened the two doors and waved a hand inside. "So you'll be in this one, Mr. and Mrs. Nichols, and your children will be next door. There's only the two rooms this side, so you have the whole upstairs to yourself. We have a selection of cereals for breakfast, or Jack will do you egg on toast. He does a lovely egg on toast." "Thank you." She handed him the keys, held his gaze a millisecond longer than was strictly necessary. "I'm going to guess you like yours gently poached, am I right?" Ed glanced behind him, checking that she was addressing him. "I am, aren't I?" However they come." He didn't really want to dwell on the thought of gelatinous white eggs. "However they come," she repeated slowly, her eyes not leaving his. She raised one eyebrow, smiled at him again, then headed downstairs, her pack of small dogs a moving hairy sea around her feet. From the corner of his eye, he could see Jess smirking. Don't. He dropped their bags onto the bed. My bag's first bath. Nicky rubbed at the small of his back.
I need to revise, said Tansy. I have exactly 17.5 hours until the Olympiad.
She gathered her books under her arm and disappeared into the next room.
Come and give Norman a walk first, sweetheart, Jess said. Get some fresh air. It'll help you sleep later.
She unzipped a hold-all and pulled a hoodie over her head. When she lifted her arms, a crescent of bare stomach was briefly visible, pale and startling. Her face emerged through the neck opening.
I'll be gone for at least 30 minutes. Or I could make it longer.
As she adjusted her ponytail, she glanced towards the stairs and lifted an eyebrow at him.
Just saying.
Funny. He could hear her laughing as they disappeared. Ed lay down on the nylon bedspread, feeling his hair lift slightly with static electricity, and pulled his phone from his pocket.
So, here's the good news, said Paul Wilkes. The police have completed their initial investigations. The preliminary results show no obvious motive on your side. There is no evidence that you extracted a profit from Deanna Lewis or her brother's trading activities. More pertinently, there is no sign that you made any money at all from the launch of SVAX, other than the same share gains that would be made by any employee. Obviously, there would be a higher proportion of profit, given your overall shareholding, but they can find no links to offshore accounts or any attempt to conceal on your side. That's because there were none. Also, the investigating team says that they have uncovered a number of accounts in Michael Lewis's family's names, which suggests a clear attempt to conceal his actions. They have obtained trading records which show that he was trading large volume immediately prior to the announcement, another red flag for them.
Okay. He was still talking, but the signal was patchy, and Ed struggled to hear him. He stood and walked over to the window. Tansy was running round and round the pub garden, shrieking happily. The small, yappy dogs were following her. Jess was standing, her arms folded, laughing. Norman was in the middle of the space, gazing at them all, a bemused, immovable object in a sea of madness. Ed thought he knew how he felt. He put his hand over his other ear.
Does that mean I can come back now? Is it sorted?
He had a sudden vision of his office, a mirage in a desert.
Hold your horses. Here's the less good news. Michael Lewis wasn't just trading stocks. He was trading options on the stock.
Trading what? He blinked.
Okay, now you're speaking Polish. Seriously?
There was a short silence. Ed pictured him in his wood-paneled office, rolling his eyes.
Options allow a trader to leverage his, or in this case her, investment and generate substantially more in profits.
But what does that have to do with me?
Well, the level of profits he generated from the options is significant, so the whole case moves up a gear. Which brings me to the bad news.
That wasn't the bad news, he sighed.
Ed, why didn't you tell me you'd written Deanna Lewis a damn check?
Ed blinked.
The check. She cashed a check written by you for £5,000 to her bank account.
So, and here, from the elaborately slow and careful tenor of his voice, it was possible to picture the eye roll again.
It links you financially to what Deanna Lewis was doing. You enabled some of that trade.
But it was just a few grand to help her out. She had no money.
Whether or not you extracted a profit from it, you had a clear financial interest in Lewis, and it came just before SVAX went live. The emails, we could argue, were inconclusive, but this means it's not just her word against yours, Ed.
He stared out at the moorland. Tansy was jumping up and down and waving a stick at the slobbering dog. Her glasses had gone askew on her nose, and she was laughing. Jess scooped her up from behind and hugged her.
Meaning? Meaning, Ed. Defending you just got a whole lot tougher.
Ed had only properly disappointed his father once in his whole life. That's not to say he wasn't a general disappointment. He knew his father would have preferred a son who was more obviously in his own mould, upright, determined, driven, a sort of filial marine. But he managed to override whatever private dismay he felt at this quiet, geeky boy, and decided instead that, as he so clearly couldn't sort him out, an expensive education would. The fact that the meagre funds their parents saved over their working years sent Ed to private school, and not his sister, was the great, unacknowledged resentment of their family. He often wondered whether, if they had known then what a huge emotional hurdle they were planting in front of her, they would still have done it. Ed never could convince her that it was purely because she was so good at everything that they never felt the need to send her. He was the one who spent every waking hour in his room, or glued to a screen. He was the one who was hopeless at sports. But no. Against all available evidence, he was convinced that an expensive minor public school with the motto, "Sports maketh the man," would maketh his son. "This is a great opportunity we're giving you, Edward. Better than your mother or I ever had," he said repeatedly. "Don't waste it." So when he opened the report at the end of Ed's first year, which used the words disengaged and lackluster performance and, worst of all, not really a team player, he stared at the letter, and Ed watched uncomfortably as the colour drained from his face. He couldn't tell him he didn't really like the school, with its braying packs of bullying, over-entitled Henrys. He couldn't tell him that no matter how many times they made him run round the rugby pitch, he was never going to like rugby. He couldn't explain that it was the possibilities of the pixelated screen and what you could create from it that really interested him, and that he felt he could make a life out of it. His father's face actually sagged with disappointment with the sheer bloody waste of it all, and he realized he had no choice. "I'll do better next year, Dad," he said. Ed Nichols was due to report to the City of London Police in a matter of days. He tried to imagine the expression his father would wear when he heard that his son, the son he now boasted about to his ex-army colleagues, the pride with which he would say, "Of course, I don't understand what it is he actually does, but apparently all this software stuff is the future," was quite possibly about to be prosecuted for insider trading. He tried to picture his father's head turning on that frail neck, the shock and disappointment pulling his weary features down even as he tried to disguise it, and his gently pursed lips as he grasped there was nothing he could say or do. And Ed made a decision. He would ask his lawyer to prolong the proceedings as long as possible. He would throw every penny of his own money at the case to delay the announcement of his supposed crime. But he could not go to that family lunch, no matter how ill his father was. He would be doing his father a favour. By staying away, he would actually be protecting him. Ed Nichols stood in the little pink hotel bedroom that smelt of air freshener and disappointment, and stared out at the bleak moors, at the little girl who had flopped onto the damp grass and was pulling the ears of the dog as he sat, tongue lolling, an expression of idiotic ecstasy on his great features, and he wondered why, given that he was so evidently doing the right thing, he felt like a complete shit.
Chapter 19. Jess. Tansy was nervous. Even though she would only admit to 37% nervous, maybe 38. She refused supper and declined to come downstairs even for a break, preferring to curl up on the pink nylon coverlet and plough through her maths papers while nibbling at what remained of the breakfast picnic. Jess was surprised. Her daughter rarely suffered from nerves when it came to anything maths-related. She did her best to reassure her, but it was hard when she had no idea what she was talking about. "We're nearly there. It's all good, Tans. Nothing to worry about." "Do you think I'll sleep tonight?" "Of course you'll sleep tonight. But if I don't, I might do really badly." "Even if you don't sleep, you'll do fine. And I've never known you not sleep." "I'm worried that I'll worry too much to sleep." "I'm not worried that you'll worry."
Just relax. You'll be fine. It will all be fine.
When Jess kissed her, she saw that she had chewed her nails right down to the quick. Mr. Nichols was in the garden. He walked up and down where she and Tansy had been half an hour earlier, talking avidly into his phone. He stopped and stared at it a couple of times, then stepped up onto a white plastic garden chair, presumably to get better reception. He stood there, wobbling, utterly oblivious to the curious glances of those inside as he gesticulated and swore. Jess gazed through the window, unsure whether to go and interrupt him. There were a few old men in the bar, gathered around the landlady as she chatted from the other side. They looked at her incuriously over their pints.
"Work, is it?"
The landlady followed her gaze through the window. "Oh, yeah, never stops," Jess raised a smile. "I'll take him a drink." Mr. Nichols was seated on a low stone wall when she finally walked out. His elbows were on his knees and he was staring at the grass. Jess held out the pint, and he stared at it for a moment, then took it from her.
"Thanks."
He looked exhausted. "Everything okay?"
"No."
He took a long gulp of his beer.
"Nothing's okay."
She sat down a few feet away. "Anything I can help with?"
"No."
They sat in silence. The pub was shabby, but she quite liked it. It was so peaceful there, with nothing around them except the breeze rippling across the moors, the distant cries of birds, and the gentle hum of conversation from inside. She was going to say something about the landscape, when a voice broke into the still air.
"Fuck it," Mr. Nichols said vehemently. "Just fuck it." It was so startling that Jess flinched.
"I just can't believe my fucking life has turned into this mess," his voice cracked. "I can't believe that I can work and work for years and the whole thing can fall apart like this. For what? For fucking what? It's only food poisoning. I'm not talking about the fucking kebab." He dropped his head into his hands.
"I don't want to talk about it."
He shot her an angry look.
"Okay."
"That's the thing. Legally, I'm not meant to talk to anyone about any of this." She didn't look at him.
"I can't tell a soul. I mean, legally."
She stretched out a leg and gazed at the sunset. "Well, I don't count, do I? I'm a cleaning wench." He let out a breath.
"Fuck it," he said again.
And then he told her, his head down, his hands raking his short dark hair. He told her about a girlfriend whom he couldn't think how to let down nicely, and an ex-wife who never quite left him alone, and how his whole life had come crashing down. He told her about his company, and how he should have been there now celebrating the launch of his last 6 years' obsessive work, and how instead he had to stay away from everything and everyone he knew, all the while facing the prospect of prosecution. He told her about his dad, who was sick, and who was going to be even sicker when he heard what had happened. And he told her about the lawyer who had just rung to inform him that shortly after he returned from this trip, his presence would be required at a police station in London, where he would be charged with insider trading, a charge that could win him up to 20 years in prison. By the time he'd finished, she felt winded.
"Everything I've ever worked for, everything I cared about. I'm not allowed to go into my own office. I can't even go back to my flat in case the press hear of it and I let slip what's happened. I can't go and see my own dad because then he'll die knowing what a bloody idiot his son is. And the stupid thing is, I miss him. I really miss him."
Jess digested this for a few minutes. He smiled bleakly at the sky.
"And you know the best bit? It's my birthday."
"What?"
"Today. It's my birthday."
"Today? Why didn't you say anything?"
"Because I'm 34 years old, and a 34-year-old man sounds like a dick talking about birthdays."
He took a swig of his beer.
"And what with the whole food poisoning thing, I didn't feel I had much to celebrate."
He looked sideways at her.
"Plus, you might have started singing Happy Birthday in the car."
"I'll sing it out here."
"Please don't, things are bad enough."
Jess's head was reeling.
She couldn't believe all the stuff Mr. Nichols was carrying around. If it had been anyone else, she might have put her arm round them, attempted to say something comforting. But Mr. Nichols was prickly, and who could blame him? It felt like offering an elastoplast to someone who had just had an arm amputated. "Things will get better, you know," she said, when she couldn't think of anything else to say. "Karma will get that girl who stitched you up." He pulled a face.
"Karma?"
"It's like I tell the kids, good things happen to good people, you just have to keep faith. Well, I must have been a complete shit in a past life." "Come on, you still have property, you have cars, you have your brain, you have expensive lawyers. You can work this out."
"How come you're such an optimist?"
"Because things do come right."
"And that's from a woman who doesn't have enough money to catch a train."
Jess kept her gaze on the craggy hillside. "Because it's your birthday, I'm going to let that one go."
Mr. Nichols sighed. "Sorry, I know you're trying to help, but right now I find your relentless positivity exhausting."
"No.
You find driving hundreds of miles in a car with three people you don't know and a large dog exhausting."
"Go upstairs and have a long bath, and you'll feel better. Go on."
He trudged inside, the condemned man, and she sat and stared out at the slab of green moorland in front of her. She tried to imagine what it would be like to be facing prison, not to be allowed near the things or the people you loved. She tried to imagine someone like Mr. Nichols doing time. And then she decided not to think about it, and hoped quite hard that Nicky hadn't used up all the hot water. After a while, she walked inside with the empty glasses. She leant over the bar, where the landlady was watching an episode of Holmes Under the Hammer. The men sat in silence behind her, watching it too, or gazing rheumily into their pints.
"Mrs. Deakins, it's actually my husband's birthday today. Would you mind doing me a favour?"
Mr. Nichols finally came downstairs at 8:30, wearing the exact clothes he'd worn that afternoon, and the previous afternoon. Jess knew he had bathed as his hair was damp and he had shaved. "So what's in your bag then? A body?" "What?" He walked over to the bar. He gave off a faint scent of Wilkinson Sword soap. "You've worn the same clothes since we left." He looked down, as if to check. "Oh, no, these are clean." "You have the exact same T-shirt and jeans, for every day." "Saves thinking about it." She looked at him for a minute, then decided to bite back what she had been about to say. It was his birthday, after all. "Oh, you look nice, though," he said suddenly, as if he'd only just noticed. She had changed into a blue sundress and a cardigan. She had been going to save it for the Olympiad, but had figured that this was important. "Well, thank you. One has to make the effort to fit one's surroundings, doesn't one?" "What, you left your flat cap and dog-haired jeans behind?" "You're about to be sorry for your sarcasm, because I have a surprise in store." "A surprise?" He looked instantly wary. "It's a good one." "Here." Jess handed him one of two glasses she had prepared earlier, to Mrs. Deakins's amusement. "They hadn't made a cocktail here since 1997, Mrs. Deakins had observed, as Jess checked the dusty bottles behind the optics. "I figure you're well enough." "What is this?" He stared at it suspiciously. "Scotch, triple sec, and orange juice." He took a sip. "And then a larger one. This is all right." "I knew you'd like it. I made it specially for you. It's called a mithering bastard." The white plastic tables sat in the middle of the threadbare lawn, with two place settings of stainless steel cutlery and a candle in a wine bottle in the middle. Jess had wiped the chairs with a bar cloth so that there was no green left on them, and now pulled one out for him. "We're eating al fresco. Birthday treat." She ignored the look he gave her. "If you would like to take your seat, I'll go and inform the kitchen that you're here." "It's not breakfast muffins, is it?" "Of course it's not breakfast muffins." She pretended to be offended. As she walked towards the kitchen, she muttered, "Tansy and Nicky had the rest of those." When she arrived back at the table, Norman had flopped down on Mr. Nichols's foot. Jess suspected Mr. Nichols would quite like to have moved it, but she had been sat on by Norman before, and he was a dead weight. You just had to sit there and pray that he shifted before your foot went black and fell off. "How was your aperitif?" Mr. Nichols gazed at his empty cocktail glass. Delicious. Well, the main course is on its way. I'm afraid it's just the two of us this evening, as the other guests had prior arrangements. Waterloo Road and some completely insane algebraic equations. You know us too well. Jess sat down in her chair, and as she did, Mrs. Deakins picked her way across the lawn, the Pomeranians yapping at her feet. With the same care as a head waiter holds up cordon bleu dishes in a 5-star restaurant, she held aloft 2 plates, upon each of which sat a huge foil-clad pie and chips. "There you go," she said, placing them on the table. "Steak and kidney from Ian up the road. He does a lovely meat pie." Jess was so hungry by then that she thought she could probably have eaten Ian. "Fantastic, thank you," she said, laying a paper napkin on her lap. Mrs. Deakins stood and gazed around, as if seeing the setting for the first time. "We never eat out here. Lovely idea. I might offer it to my other customers. And those cocktails, I could make a package of it." Jess thought about the old men in the bar. "Shame not to," she said, passing the vinegar across to Mr. Nichols. He seemed temporarily stunned. Mrs. Deakins rubbed her hands on her apron. "Well, Mr. Nichols, your wife is certainly determined to show you a good time on your birthday," she said, with a wink. He glanced up at her. "Oh, there's never a quiet moment with Jess," he said, letting his gaze slide back to hers. "So, how long have you two been married?"
10 years.
3 years.
"The children are from my previous marriages," Jess said, slicing into the pie.
"Oh, that's..."
"I rescued her," said Mr. Nichols, "from the side of the road."
"He did."
"Well, that's very romantic." Mrs. Deakins' smile wavered a little. "Not really. She was being arrested at the time."
"I've explained all that. God, these chips are delicious."
"You have. And those policemen were very understanding, considering." Mrs. Deakins had started to back away.
"Well, that's lovely. It's nice that you're still together."
"We get by."
"We have no choice right now."
"That's true too.
Could you bring out some red sauce?"
"Oh, good idea. Darling."
As she disappeared, Mr. Nichols nodded towards the candle and the plates, and then he looked up at Jess, and he was no longer scowling. "This is actually the best pie and chips I've ever eaten in a weird bed and breakfast somewhere I've never heard of on the North Yorkshire moors.
I'm so glad.
Happy birthday." They ate in companionable silence. It was astonishing how much better a hot meal and a fearsomely strong cocktail could make you feel. Upstairs, Jess could hear Nicky watching television, occasional growls of frustration echoing through the open window when the static electricity interrupted his program. Crows cawed obscenely from a nearby telephone wire. Norman groaned and flopped over onto his side, releasing Mr. Nichols's foot. Mr. Nichols stretched his legs speculatively, perhaps trying to see whether he still could. He looked up at her and raised his refreshed cocktail glass. "Seriously, I do feel better. Thank you." Without his glasses on, she noticed how that he had ridiculously long eyelashes. It made her feel weirdly conscious of the candle in the middle of the table. It had been a bit of a joke when she'd asked for it. "Well, it was the least I could do. You did rescue us from the side of the road. I don't know what we would have done." He speared another chip and held it aloft. "Well, I like to look after my staff. I think I preferred it when we were married."
"Cheers."
He grinned at her, and it was so genuine and unexpected that she found herself grinning back. "Here's to tomorrow, and Tansy's future. And a general absence of more crap. I'll drink to that." The evening crept into night, eased by strong alcohol and the happy knowledge that nobody had to sleep in a car or needed frequent, urgent access to a bathroom. Nicky came down, ate his pie and chips, gazed suspiciously from under his fringe at the men in the snug, who gazed equally suspiciously back at him, and retreated to his bedroom to watch television. Jess drank 3 glasses of acidic Liebfrau milk, went inside to check on Tansy and take her some food. She made her promise she would not revise later than 10 o'clock.
"Can I keep working in your room? Nicky has the telly on."
"That's fine," Jess said.
"You smell of wine," Tansy said pointedly. "That's because we're sort of on holiday. Mums are allowed to smell of wine when they're sort of on holiday."
"Hmm." She gave Jess a severe look, and turned back to her books. Nikki was sprawled on one of the single beds watching television. She shut the door behind her and sniffed the air.
You haven't been smoking, have you? You've still got my stash, if you remember. You said you were going to throw it away.
Oh, yes. She had completely forgotten.
But you slept without it. Last night and the night before. Well, that's good, right?
He shrugged.
I think the words you were looking for are, yes, it's great that I no longer need illegal substances simply to fall asleep.
Right, up you get for a minute. I need you to help me lift a mattress. When he didn't move, she said, I can't sleep in there with Mr. Nichols. We'll make another bed on the floor of your room, okay? He sighed, but he got up and helped. He didn't wince anymore when he moved, she noticed. On the carpet beside Tansy's bed, the mattress left just enough room for them to slide in and out of the door, which now only opened 6 inches. Well, this is going to be fun if I need the loo in the night.
Go last thing. You're a big boy.
She told Nikki to turn off the television at 10 so as not to disturb Tansy, and left them both upstairs. The candle had long since expired in the stiff evening breeze, and when they could no longer see each other to talk, they moved indoors, seating themselves in the corner of the snug as far as possible from Mrs. Deakins and the silent men at the bar. They had moved from parents and first jobs onto relationships. Jess told him about Marty and how he had once bought her an extension lead for her birthday, protesting, "But you said you needed one!" In turn, he told her about Lara the ex and how on her birthday he had once arranged for a chauffeur-driven car to pick her up for a surprise breakfast at a posh hotel with her friends, then spent the morning in Harvey Nichols with a personal shopper and an unlimited budget, and how when he'd met her for lunch, she had complained bitterly because he hadn't taken the whole day off work. Jess thought she'd quite like to slap Lara the ex quite hard around her overly made-up face. She had invented this face. It was probably more drag queen than was strictly necessary.
Did you have to pay her alimony?
Didn't have to, but I did, until she let herself into the apartment and helped herself to my stuff for the third time.
Did you get it back?
It wasn't worth the hassle. If a screen print of Mao Zedong is that important to her, she can have it.
What was it worth?
What?
The painting.
A few grand.
You and I speak different languages, Mr. Nichols.
Okay, then, how much maintenance does your ex pay you?
Nothing.
Nothing. His eyebrows had lifted to somewhere around his hairline. Nothing at all.
He's a mess. You can't punish someone for being a mess.
Even if it means you and the kids have to struggle.
How could she explain? It had taken her 2 years to work it out herself. She knew the kids missed him, but she was secretly relieved Marty had gone. She was relieved that she didn't have to worry about whether he was going to hijack their futures with his next ill-thought-out scheme. She was weary of his black moods and that he was permanently exhausted by the children. Mostly, she was tired of never doing anything right. Marty had liked the 16-year-old Jess, the wild, impulsive, responsibility-free version. Then he had weighed her down with responsibility and hadn't liked who had emerged from it. When he's sorted himself out, I'll make sure he contributes his share again, yes. But we're okay. Jess glanced upstairs to where Nikki and Tansy were sleeping. I think this will be our turning point. And besides, you probably won't understand this, and I know everyone thinks they're a bit odd, but I'm the lucky one having them. They're kind and funny. They have ideas about stuff. She poured herself another glass of wine and took a gulp. It was definitely getting easier to drink. She just wasn't sure how much tooth enamel she'd have afterwards. They're nice kids.
Thank you, she said. Actually, I realised something today. The last few days have been the first time I can remember where I just got to be with them. Not working, not running around doing housework or shopping or trying to catch up on all this stuff. It's been nice just hanging out with them, if that doesn't sound daft.
It doesn't. And Nicky's sleeping. He never sleeps. I'm not sure what you did for him, but he seems...
Oh, we just redressed the balance a little. Jess raised her glass. Then one nice thing happened on your birthday.
You cheered my boy up.
Well, that was yesterday. She thought for a moment.
You didn't vomit once.
Okay, stop now. She could no longer see him properly as they were side by side on the bench, but whether it was just the food or perhaps the 4 pints of beer on top of the cocktail, or perhaps even just not having to look her in the eye, Mr. Nichols's whole body had finally relaxed. He leant back,